Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
What the Federal Reserve is doing these days is manipulating the forward market. In other words, it will go into Wall Street and it will say, we promised to buy the Dow Jones average at 50 points higher than it is today next week. Well, once it makes a promise to buy, the speculators will see that, and they will begin to bid up the prices to what the Federal Reserve promises to pay for the stocks. And it can keep doing that week after week and month after month, and it keep pushing up the stock market. And they can just continue to inflate the economy with credit, really like a Ponzi scheme. So the Federal Reserve is the official Ponzi scheme that keeps finance capitalism in the United States operating. Obviously, at some point, every exponential growth scheme has to stop.
And that's where we come in. The suckers who get stuck holding the bag of debts that we've been sold, while the financialists bail out and take off for the Seychelles or New Zealand. That, of course, is the voice of this week's featured guest on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, Michael Hudson. Hello, and welcome back to our discussions about who's doing what with our money and what we're doing about it. I'm Walt McCree, Senior Advisor to the Public Banking Institute, delighted to once again welcome our friend and colleague Michael Hudson for an extended interview with Ellen. We're also going to be reporting on an exciting new development in California, where last year, you may remember, Governor Newsom signed a bill into law that codified creation of municipal public banks. It was the first such legislative action in the country. Now, the same dynamic team of citizens that moved that legislation forward is back with a new bill that takes a powerful step forward by calling for the state's infrastructure bank to become a full-fledged depository public bank, enabling it to not only dramatically increase the amount of capital it has available for state investment, but to specifically tackle the many civic concerns that are in desperate need for attention, such as small, minority, or women-owned businesses, affordable housing, environmental justice concerns, to mention just a few. Ellen will be talking with Naveen Agrawal of the California Public Banking Alliance in a few moments, who is one of the authors of this new initiative. Also actively underway are other state initiatives for public banks, including a well-honed and comprehensive bill in the New York Senate and Assembly. The bill would create a safe and appropriate regulatory framework for cities and counties that are seeking to establish their own public banks. And it would allow their Department of Financial Services to issue special purpose public bank charters. But before we get to Ellen's conversation on the California development, let's take a moment here to assess where we are financially in the midst of the pandemic economic fallout. There is no question that if Congress doesn't step up to the plate to ensure that people, not just businesses, are carried through this rough period, that there will be catastrophic impacts on millions of people, perhaps worse than in the banking collapse of 2008. It's at extraordinary times such as this that we need to re-examine some of our fundamental understandings and to address fundamental weaknesses. Michael Hudson concluded his show opening comment with the statement that as the money interests exit and lose interest in a financial market value charade, the pension funds, small savers, and as he says, those who aren't in on the game, will lose whatever they have. This frightening prospect is where things stand now, and it will be interesting to see whether the Fed will continue to do the bidding of Wall Street or whether it will get serious about moving dollars into the real economy, specifically for states and municipalities that are running out of money due to the collapse of local economies. Also of interest at this time is the emergence of modern monetary theory, or MMT as you may have heard. The relevance of this emergence, precipitated in part by the issuance of Professor Stephanie Kelton's new book called The Deficit Myth, is how our mindset about our financial affairs is so built around the debt model, as Ellen, of course, has brilliantly exposed, and also the mindset of scarcity, which perpetuates our thinking about what's possible. When these are examined more closely, we see that there is no need for economy-crushing austerity that props up the financial markets, and that the government is fully capable of injecting whatever amount of money is needed to keep our citizens safe and healthy. FDR proved that model almost 90 years ago with the New Deal. Whether we will have the political fortitude that is required to go up against Wall Street remains to be seen. Now, let's go to California with Ellen and find out about that exciting new frontier that public banking protagonists there are engaging.
The COVID-19 economic shutdown has left the states with serious funding problems. Costs are way up and revenues are way down. Unfortunately, Congress has done little to help. The nearly $3 trillion CARES Act has gone mainly to bail out corporate America and the stock market. Only 5% of the funds were allocated to state and local governments, and they came with strict limitations on what they could be used for. The Federal Reserve hasn't helped much either. Its municipal liquidity facility will buy state and municipal bonds only at the market rate plus a penalty, so few states are likely to use it. States desperately need new sources of funding, and one option is to form their own banks. The state-owned bank could then borrow from the Fed's discount window virtually interest-free, and it could multiply its available loan funds by leveraging its capital. Low-interest loans could then be directed into the local economy where needed. Two California legislators took that bold step last week, filing a bill to turn the California Infrastructure and Development Bank into a true state-owned bank. I'm speaking now with Naveen Agrawal, who helped draft the bill. Naveen is an affordable housing underwriter for Union Bank and is with the California Public Banking Alliance. Great to be talking to you, Naveen.
Great to be speaking with you as well, Ellen.
Tell us a bit about the bill. Tell us about it and what you want to achieve with it and how it would work.
Sure. I think you set it up well. Assembly Bill 310 is meant to address, first and foremost, what the federal response has failed to address in response to the coronavirus. As you mentioned, the Federal Reserve has made available a liquidity facility at basically 2 to 3 times what the market rate is, or at least plus a penalty, which means that no states, except for Illinois, have really availed themselves of that money. In addition, in California, we have a lot of undocumented workers who are unable to receive aid. They had to receive aid under Governor Newsom through through basically nonprofit charities who were doled out about $75 million to be distributed to 150,000 people. All that to say that the response that we've been able to see has left a lot of people without any real aid. What we're trying to do in AB 310 is twofold. First, it is to expand small business lending. What we're doing is we are taking money from what is essentially California's checking account, the pooled money investment account. It's a $100 billion checking account that state uses to pay its expenses, but is also invested in things like commercial paper and in federal treasuries. What we're trying to do is move about what is in commercial paper, about 8%, in our case, what we're asking for is 10%, about $10 billion, to go into an existing infrastructure bank. This existing infrastructure bank was set up in 1994 to do infrastructure lending as well as small business lending and small business guarantees. This bank has about $500 million in assets right now, so this would be a huge increase. But the idea is basically to expand on one thing that they're already doing and to create a new product line. The thing that they're already doing is small business lending and guarantees. What we're trying to do is create a targeted lending program for emergency lending to, ideally, what we're doing is we're creating a set of criteria that give preferential treatment to smaller borrowers in disadvantaged communities. The goal is to mandate that a percentage of loans go towards loans that meet that criteria. Secondly, within that, we are creating a loan guarantee program. We are stepping up a loan guarantee that the iBank already has for small business loans from 95% to 100% for small business loans that need to meet a set of criteria. Secondly, what we're trying to do in this bill is create an emergency lending facility for municipalities and local agencies. As I mentioned, the Fed has created such a window, as you said, penalty rates. So what this is trying to do is make it so that the iBank can do short-term lending to municipalities, to school districts. And keep in mind that bond issuers like the City of Los Angeles, for instance, have AA ratings. And so the thought is by creating a balanced portfolio, just like the PMIA wants, you can invest in the health and well-being of cities, and you can then collect payments on those bonds rather than having that bond servicing go outside to private investors. Mm-hmm. Lastly, what this bill is trying to do is create a depository for states' deposits. Right now, a lot of the money for the states' deposits sit in the PMIA. In addition, we have some of the money from that sits in national banks, basically for cash management services. The goal is to be able to move some of that money into a state depository, which the iBank would be. In order for that to happen, we have to establish the iBank with some sort of insurance. And what we're trying to do is condition the depository function of the iBank on receipt of a master account with the Federal Reserve. What this does is it creates Federal Reserve oversight. The deposits would still be collateralized, and this speaks ultimately to what you were saying at first, Ellen, in that money from the Fed right now costs a quarter point. If you get it from a commercial bank, it might cost 1.5%. By becoming a member of the Federal Reserve, you get access to that overnight lending rate, which you can then pass on those benefits to, you know, small businesses or municipalities as needed.
Well, that sounds great. I think currently, isn't the Treasury's investment pool earning 1.3%? So wouldn't you have to pay that to get the deposits in order to break even with the state?
Yeah, that's correct. Right now, I think it's earning just about 1.2% as of June on an annual basis. You know, overall, PMIA, its yield is actually its lowest priority concern. Its first priority is safety. Its second priority is liquidity. And its third priority is return. In speaking with the folks who administer this, return is really less of a concern, especially with Fed funds rate at a historical lows as it has been for the past 10 years. Over the past 10 years, the past two are really the only, or the first 2 years where the PMIA has even been over 1%. Prior to that, in the 90s, it was in 4% range. That said, this would have to, you know, produce some yield. We're confident that this can do that, like I said, by creating a balanced portfolio.
And these loans would be, of course, more long-term, so they're not immediately liquid. So for liquidity, I guess the idea would be you would go to the Federal Reserve for that as needed. Is that correct?
That would be the longer-term solution. The shorter-term solution would be to do rolling maturities, like 180-day maturities. And you can still make loan guarantees, for instance, against that kind of an investment. But what we're trying to do is position this so that you can do rolling maturities until such point as we have membership within the Federal Reserve.
I know it's very similar to what the Bank of North Dakota does, where they also have access to the Federal Reserve, and then they make that liquidity available to local regions.
Right.
Yeah.
The Bank of North Dakota is insured by the full faith and credit of the state, and they were able to do that because they were founded in 1919. And right now, California would not want to touch that. So obviously this bill is ambitious. There's no denying it. But the thought is that we can move the needle, particularly on small business and in municipal lending, by creating a mechanism and then using either the CARES Act, because the CARES Act has a provision, which is the provision on, it's like 4003B, I think, that set up the Municipal Liquidity Facility by allowing the Fed to make guarantees. So we could do short-term guarantees under the Fed, but more broadly, public bank, the most recent public bank to be created was actually the Bank of American Samoa, which was chartered via the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. So we think that there's an opportunity there. We have to rely more on the Fed than the Bank of North Dakota does, because we are deliberately not trying to put the full faith and credit of California on the line.
Right. And we are in desperate times. I mean, emergencies call for radical measures. We know that's when radical things happen, like FDR taking the dollar off the gold standard altogether. People said at the time, can he do that? But he did it. And, you know, of course, all the backstops they did for the banks then and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, really, what FDR did is what opened up the possibility for this. The main issue that we're trying to resolve is that the Fed wants to create a $3 trillion CARES Act. And what we're seeing, and what a lot of modern monetary theory talks about, is that we're not actually taxing before we spend. We're spending, and then we're taxing. And the way that we spend is by printing money. But we only do that at the federal level, which means that states like California, which just finished paying off a $10 billion loan from the Fed to pay off unemployment from 2008, they finished paying that off 2 years ago. Now they're asking for even more money, and they're going to be paying that off for another decade, which, by the way, translates to small businesses who have to face higher taxes, right? So what we're really trying to do is spread some of that wealth that the Fed can create, especially in a hyper-low inflationary environment.
So you all have mobilized a lot of support already for this bill. California Public Banking Alliance managed to mobilize a huge amount of support for AB 857 last fall and got it passed against the prognoses of many critics. So could you tell us a little bit about how that's going and what kind of support you have?
Sure, of course. Last year, we worked with the same two assembly members who were authors of the bill, Assemblymember Miguel Santiago from LA and Assemblymember David Chu from San Francisco. Last year's bill authorized municipalities within the state to create their own public bank to be chartered by the DBO, the Department of Business Oversight. This year, we teamed up with the same two assembly members as authors of our bill. And we've also been able to reach out to other assembly members who are joining on as co-authors or joint sponsors of the bill. Another thing that has changed this year is that we've also engaged California Reinvestment Coalition. They are co-sponsors of the bill. They have really brought a lot of the perspective from smaller businesses as well as smaller financial institutions, and that's been enormously helpful, especially when we how vitally small businesses need to be targeted for support right now. And then we also this year have been able to engage with the California Labor Federation as well as UFCW 770, Union of Food and Commercial Workers here in LA. Together they represent over 800,000 workers in the Southern California region. And that's been enormously powerful for us as well in terms of drawing these connections between what is, you know, what you've talked about, Ellen, as a democratic approach, an infrastructural approach to finance, and what that translates to for protection for frontline workers, for financing for projects, and for small businesses, for liquidity for such businesses. I think that's really been powerful. And I think in engaging labor, we've also started to see some of the long-term vision that I think, at the Public Banking Institute, as well as in the California side, talked about for a while, which is where you start to see reparative economics become possible, wherein you have, you know, a pension plan that might be invested in an infrastructure project rather than having both these two financed separately.
Well, that sounds very promising. I wish you all good luck. Where people can go if they want to find out more information or to support the movement?
Absolutely. I'd be glad to direct folks to ab310.org. We have a few one-pagers up there as well as a call to action on how you can support, even if you're from out of state. This is obviously a movement that is across the country, and whether you want to support or you want to learn more, we're happy to be a part of the conversation, and you can also reach out more directly at publicbankla@gmail.com.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ellen.
We're just speaking with Naveen Agrawal, who helped draft AB 310 and is with the California Public Banking Alliance. My guest today is Dr. Michael Hudson, who we're delighted to have on our Public Banking Institute Advisory Board, and who really should be advising the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. But BlackRock seems to have gotten the job. Paul Craig Roberts, who is former Assistant Treasury Secretary under Reagan, called Michael Hudson the greatest economist on the planet. He's a Wall Street financial analyst, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of over 24 books, including Killing the Host and one called And Forgive Them Their Debts, which are both particularly relevant today. So it's great to be speaking with you, Michael.
It's good to be back, Ellen.
Thanks. So you recently wrote in the Washington Post, the coronavirus outbreak is serving as a mind expansion exercise, making hitherto unthinkable solutions thinkable. Debts that can't be paid won't be. A debt jubilee may be the best way out. So for anyone who hasn't heard you explain this before, could you explain what you mean by a debt jubilee and why it may be the best way out and what the real crisis is that it's the best way out of?
Well, there was a debt problem that's been mounting up ever since World War II, and that is every economic recovery, every business cycle that started since 1945 has started from a higher and higher level of debt. And most people thought they were getting rich off debt because most bank credit, 80% of bank loans are mortgage loans. They're made against real estate. And as banks sought to expand the market, they lent more and more money against real estate. In the 1960s, when I first bought a house, you had to have the debt service not more than 25% of your income. You had to put down 30% of the price of the house. And so basically a house was worth whatever a bank would lend. Well, gradually, by the time that the economy collapsed in 2008, or rather the time of the financial system collapse, banks were making loans with zero down payment. You didn't need 30%. The requirement that the mortgage be affordable, 25% of your income, went out the window because banks would lend any amount of money regardless of what you were making. And even the interest didn't have to be paid. They were, instead of having a self-amortizing mortgage that in 30 years of paying the bank, you'd own the house, you'd pay the bank after 30 years and you wouldn't own any more at all, because you wouldn't be paying any amortization. So basically, the banks lent so much money against housing, pushing housing up to such a high price that after paying the mortgage costs, or if you couldn't afford a house if you were a renter, and after paying the debt service and the credit card debt, the other debt, and after paying the insurance costs and taxes, you really didn't have any money left for basic goods and services that you produced, except for the bare minimum of food, clothing, transportation. So a point has been reached already at the time the virus broke out of how can the economy continue to grow. For 95% of the population, the economy stopped growing in 2008 when Obama bailed out the banks and left all of the debts in place. And since 2008, all of the growth of GDP, all the increase in national income, has accrued just to the wealthiest 5% of the population. And that means that for 95% of the population, the economy hasn't been growing at all. It's absolutely been shrinking. And the question is, how are you going to grow if you leave all of the debt service in place, if you leave all of the debt-pyramided housing in place, if you leave all of the high-priced bonds and stocks in place that are so high-priced that they don't yield an income for retirement anymore, that the economy reached a point already by the beginning of this year as to you have to choose. Either you can pay all the debts and continue to pay the growth in money to the 5% that basically are the creditor and financial class, or you write down the debts and let the economy grow again. So who is the economy going to be run for? Is it going to be run for the banks and Wall Street, or is it going to be run for Main Street? Well, you said I should be an advisor to the Federal Reserve and Treasury. They wouldn't pay any attention to anything I said because they run the economy for Wall Street. And the Federal Reserve has created, as you've just seen with the virus, and the quantitative easing since 2008, $4.5 trillion for the Obama bailout, and then another $2 trillion to said to go up to $10 trillion, essentially just to buy stocks and bonds and push up the prices of assets that the 5% own. So the Federal Reserve basically is working against Main Street. It's working only for its constituency, which are the commercial banks, instead of trying to think, how can the economy free itself from this debt overhead? It certainly can't work its way out of debt because nobody's earning enough money to amortize, that is, to pay off the principal. All they can do is try to pay the current interest charges. So the economy has painted itself into a corner, and that's the problem that I address in Killing the Host and in all of the books that I write and all of the interviews that I do.
Yeah, I totally agree with all that. So you mentioned about this $4.5 trillion, which is levered up from $4.5 billion. I just wondered, how do they get away with that? I mean, it's not a bank. So why do they figure 10-to-1? I mean, they could do 100-to-1. The Federal Reserve can issue whatever they want. I guess one of my basic questions about the Federal Reserve is people say that they could actually go bankrupt, their balance sheet doesn't balance and all that. Do they actually have a balance sheet that counts? I mean,
sure, they
why?
Have a balance sheet, but the question is, what is a balance sheet? You have assets on the left-hand side and liabilities and net worth on the right-hand side. Now, the Federal Reserve can create also a credit, it can do what a bank does. If you go into a bank and you want to borrow money, the bank will create an account for you just on the computer. Here's $100,000 we're putting in your checking account. Go buy a house or do anything. And in exchange, the bank has an asset, a claim on you for repayment at interest. Well, the Federal Reserve also has its computers, and it can do anything on the balance sheet. So it can tell the corporations and the banks, give us sort of like we're the Statue of Liberty. Give us your poor junk loans. Give us your bad debts. Give us all of the junk, and we will create a deposit, 100 cents on the dollar for it, and we will pick up all of your bad loans, and we know that the loans can't be paid because the economy can't pay. And as on the asset side of our balance sheet, we'll say we have the claim against you, and on and we will then give you the money for it, and we will try to make sure that we don't have to lose money on these assets that we've let you pledge to us, because we're going to keep bidding up the market higher and higher and higher. And we can do that not only by buying stocks and buying junk bonds and buying packaged mortgages, but we can do financial tricks. Like you mentioned Paul Craig Roberts before. When he was Under Secretary of the Treasury for International Affairs, he told me that what the Federal Reserve is doing these days is manipulating the forward market. In other words, it will go into Wall Street and it will say, we promise to buy the Dow Jones average at 50 points higher than it is today next week. Well, once it makes a promise to buy, the speculators will see that, and they will begin to bid up the prices to what the Federal Reserve promises to pay for the stocks. And it can keep doing that week after week and month after month, and it can be keep pushing up the stock market. That's how it pushes up the bond market, by promising to buy bonds at a higher and higher price, meaning an existing bond will yield less and less interest income. And they can just continue to inflate the economy with credit, really like a Ponzi scheme. So the Federal Reserve is the official Ponzi scheme that keeps finance capitalism in the United States operating and keeps the economy going. And obviously, at some point, every exponential growth scheme has to stop, because otherwise you'd have an infinite amount of debt. And so at a certain point, the Fed will sit down with the main Wall Street firms and the main billionaires that are behind the firms, and they'll say, well, you know, really the game's over. We've got to let it go. And all of the these investors will say, okay, we'll take the money and run. And that's what a lot are all doing already. We're going to buy gold. We're going to buy real estate in New Zealand, so we have somewhere to run to when the economy collapses. And they're just going to drop everything, sell out, and there will be a crash with the pension funds and the small savers and people who aren't in on the game losing whatever they have.
Mm-hmm. And this goes over and over and over. But my question about the Fed's balance sheet, though, does their balance sheet have to balance?
Or every balance sheet balances, because you can treat any transaction as a balance. If you're a physicist and you're talking about a man falling flat on his face, when he falls flat on his face, that's equilibrium. Anything can be looked at as a duality of two sides of the same coin. The two sides are assets and liabilities. And if I pay you $100,000 for a broken down car, then you can say that you have an asset worth $100,000, and you owe me $100,000 for the car. That balances. It's just not a realistic balance. So balance sheets do have to balance, but they don't have to be realistic.
Of course, I think we need a universal basic income, and you think we need a debt jubilee, and we need to discuss what those are, of course. But let's say they're paid by the Federal Reserve. The argument against that is that, like real helicopter money, where you just drop money on the people and you can't bring it back, is irreversible, and therefore it would be inflationary, whereas what they do is supposedly reversible. So if you buy an asset, you're putting money into the economy, and then if the economy overheats, as they say, then you can always sell the asset back and pull the money back and shrink the money supply. And you can't do that with the UBI or writing off debts or all those various things. But it seems to me that they never can reverse their quantitative easing anyway. But what do you say to that argument?
You're quite right. Remember, the Federal Reserve helicopter only flies over Wall Street. It doesn't fly over the economy. All this $4.5 trillion of quantitative easing and all the $2 trillion that it's created under the Trump added CARES Act, all this could have been spent into the real economy. It could have been spent building infrastructure. It could have been spent supporting basic income. It could have been spent on the people and mainstream street. But instead, it was only spent on Wall Street. And the idea that, well, if you buy something, you can always make a profit. That worked for, that's what created the middle class from 1945 to about 2008. The way that almost all the middle class wealth in America was accumulated was through the rising price of housing. In other words, every family that bought a house had to pay more and more of its income and higher price to get a house, and this enriched the people who were fortunate enough to have been able to buy real estate in 1945. White people, not blacks, not Hispanics, they were redlined. But if you were a white person with a job, you could get on the middle class treadmill, debt treadmill, and actually make it work for you. But at a certain point, and everybody thought, well, I'll just keep borrowing money. Remember in 2006, 7, and 8, people thought, well, if you borrow as much as you can, forget the interest rate, no matter what, you can pay back the banks out of the rising price of the housing. Well, then the housing price stopped, and you had 10 million families, 9 or 10 million, lose their homes in the great Obama foreclosures, when he said, well, either I can support the banks or I can support my voters. Who am I going to support? Well, the banks are my campaign contributors, and I'm going to support my donor class. He invited them to the White House and said, I'm the guy standing between you and the mob with pitchforks, the voters for me, the people that Hillary called the deplorables. And he said, I'll protect you. And he did indeed. No banker went to jail. He gave the banks enormous amounts of money at the cost of the 10 million families that he exploited, and at the cost of stopping industrialization in this country, stopping the domestic market, and bringing on the Obama Depression. And of course, that's the policy that Biden is committed to. He committed himself in the last few days, saying that his intention to get reelected is not to appeal to Bernie Sanders or the left or the working class, but to try to get enough Republicans to vote for him that he can beat Trump while supporting the position that he supported as vice president, supporting the banks, writing down Social Security, cutting back Social Security, cutting back Medicare, cutting back social spending in order to give to the donor class on Wall Street. So we're going to see Obama with an exclamation point with the Biden Republican program that is likely to come into this country.
Yeah. We're in a sorry state, I think. So you're your proposal then would be that we have a debt jubilee. So can you describe what that is and where the, you know, term came from and how you would actually do it?
Well, the term jubilee came from the Bible. It was pronounced yobel. The J was pronounced Y as in Spanish in Hebrew. And yobel was the term used in Leviticus 25, saying that every 50 years you will cancel the debts, and you will free the debt servants who've been subjected to bondage, and you'll return all of the slaves to the that have been pledged to creditors as the main collateral to the debtor, and you'll return the land that they also lost. Well, the word that they used in addition to yobel, for the yobel was the horn that was blown on the jubilee to signal it, but the technical term in the Bible was duror, which was a cognate to the Babylonian word andararum, which had been used ever since Hammurabi and the Babylonian dynasty back in 1750 B.C., when Hammurabi, like every other member of his dynasty, started the reign by claiming an andararum, a clean slate, a debt cancellation. And he did this because he realized that debts grew faster than the ability to pay, and if you didn't write down the debts, then you would have much of the population falling into debt to the creditors, including wealthy members in the palace bureaucracy. And Hammurabi and other Near Eastern rulers realized that if you let people fall into debt to the creditors, then they'd have to spend their labor working for the creditors on their land, and they wouldn't be able to work on the public corvée infrastructure work. They wouldn't be able to build palaces or walls, and they wouldn't be able to pay their crops as taxes because they'd owe what is interest to the creditors. Now, the reason I mentioned Hammurabi and selected him is because in his laws, you have the first example of act of God. One of Hammurabi's laws said that, well, it's true that I canceled the debts whenever the economy needs it and when I came to the throne, but if there's an act of God, if the storm God added floods the fields with water and you can't harvest the crop, or if there's a drought, then you don't have to pay the rents or the taxes or the debts. you're freed from the debts because we don't want you to fall into bondage to the creditors, because then you'd pay them the surplus and we wouldn't have it at the palace, basically. And in other parts of his laws, he said if there's an epidemic, if there's a sickness, or if there's a military defeat, then the debts are canceled, because the whole idea is we're not going to let the money that people owe grow to such a large rate that the economy shrinks and people fall into bondage, because he knew very well that if people, if the population fell into bondage, then either they would defect to when there was constant warfare, either they'd go over to somebody else's side, or there'd be a revolution, and they'd just overthrow the ruler and cancel the debts. And that attempt to overthrow rulers who didn't cancel the debts made all through Greece and Roman antiquity, from the 8th century down to the time of the 1st century B.C. in Rome. There were just constant debtor revolts. And the question, again, ever since Roman times to modern times, has been, what do you do when the debts get too large to pay? Well, the debts were simply written down in the Near East. They were not written down in Rome, and instead you had a very small oligarchy taking over the economy and enslaving or reducing most of the population to bondage, and the result of that was the Dark Age. Well, to get back to your question, how do you cancel the debts? Look at what's happening right now with the virus. A lot of people are unemployed. For what's the number, 20 million or 40 million unemployed? They're not able to pay their rents, or they're, if they bought a house, they're not able to pay their mortgage, and they're not able to pay the other debts. So rents are going unpaid, and mortgages are going unpaid, and beginning in July and especially in August, there's talk of large-scale evictions. Millions of Americans who've lost the job, they're not getting any more money from the government. They've had to use the stimulus money they had just to buy food on the table and to break even. So if you don't write down the debts for these people, if you don't cancel the rents and say, okay, we know that you didn't have a job, you can't pay the rent. And the same is true for businesses, for restaurants. If you don't free them from the rents, then they're going to go out of business and they'll be unemployed, and you're going to have a gigantic homeless problem in the United States. Well, you can just imagine the political results of all that. Well, for one thing, now that the rents aren't being paid, people have been trying to, homeowners have been saying, and businesses, restaurants and stores, have insurance against interruption of business. The insurance companies, which are just as crooked as the banks in this country, are saying, well, we can't afford to pay you. It's true, you got insurance, but if we paid you, then we'd go broke, so we're not going to pay you. And the landlords, meanwhile, say, well, if we don't get the rent, then we can't pay the banks, and the banks will foreclose. And that's one reason why Wall Street is soaring. This is the bonanza for the really rich billionaires and multi-billionaires and big companies like Blackstone, because they think, oh boy, there's going to be another wave of foreclosures. Trump is doing as wonderful a job for us as Obama did. Under Obama, home ownership fell from 57% to about 51%. And now there's so many people who've been unable to pay their mortgages that they're going to lose the mortgages. The banks will sell the homes and the office buildings in a convulsion of sell-offs, and Blackstone and other speculators are all going to be able to get rich, and home ownership is going to plunge in the United States another 5 points, and we'll be turning away from being a homeowning middle-class society into a renter society that's more and more impoverished. And that is the result of what's going to happen if the debts are not written down. So the question is it really worth subjecting the economy to poverty, to homelessness, to close down businesses, to end the middle class in order to pay debts to the financial class that's made all of the gains and growth since 2008 and are enriched? Or do we want to say, okay, the debts can't be paid, and that means that the mortgages won't be paid, the loans won't be paid, and some of this these trillions and trillions of dollars that the financial sector and the 5% and the 1% have made are going to be given back? Well, the 1% says, we're not going to give back a penny. That's absolutely wrong. We are going to insist that the debts be paid. It's worth it to us to impoverish the economy so we can get richer, even if by getting $1, we're willing to make the economy lose $1 billion, because that's all we care about. So that's the point at which the American economy has got at today, and most of the discussions in the mainstream press don't spell out the fact that the economy, if it does not write down the debts, then we're in for a chronic depression that will last until the debts are finally written down.
So if you were to write down, I mean, so it would have to be up to Congress, like you say. I mean, they're the only one with the leverage to do it. They've got control. I mean, they could.
Or it can be up to the people in a revolution. In Rome, there were revolutions to do it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think there are a few Congress people we could get to bring a bill or something. How would you do it? Like, would the banks just write off those mortgages? Or, you know, there are some landlords who, like little old ladies who have rented out some rooms and that's their income, for example. I mean, there are some people that really probably don't deserve to be in that position, but the banks, we definitely don't seem to mind, or writing down their loans. I just wondered, exactly, if you were to have the ability to implement such a law, how would you write it?
The best thing is, in practice, you have to let nature take its course. You have to let the banks go under. You had a wonderful chance in 2008 for the banks to go under, and we've spoken before on this show about what the FDIC proposed under Sheila Bair. She said, look, the most incompetent, worst-managed bank in the worst trouble was Citibank. She said, you know, we could have taken it over. There was enough money in Citibank to pay all the insured depositors, and the speculators, the stockholders and the bondholders would have been wiped out, but the bondholders are the wealthiest 1%. We could have taken it out, and then Citibank could have been operated as a public bank, which is what you're talking about. The fact is that banking should be a public utility. Privatized banking has not really helped the economy, because privatized banking makes loans basically against collateral. And when you make loans against collateral, the house, the real estate, corporate stocks and bonds, then the effect of bank lending is to increase the price of this collateral, and you end up with a high-priced economy, high housing prices, high retirement prices, high insurance prices. And you really can't, without having a public banking system sort of built on the wreckage of the commercial banking system that has almost committed suicide, as you've described, you're not going to be able to have to go forward. You can't simply return to normalcy, because normalcy was a situation that brought us to this problem to begin with. You can't simply keep lending, bailing out the banks and giving them more and more money to increase the debt more and more, because at a certain point, the debt can't be sustained, and there will be a write-down of debts one way or another. The question is, how will the debts be written down when they can't be paid? Either you're going to have foreclosures, which was the Obama and the Biden Democratic Party solution, or you'll have the creditors lose and the banking system lose. And if you were to rewrite the laws to take away all of the special tax favoritism for the financial sector, all the special deregulation and favoritism for the banks, then they'd go under, and the government could easily take them over and operate them as public banks. More and more more like savings banks used to be. They wouldn't necessarily be able to create credit except for public authorized purposes, but they wouldn't be able to make the takeover loans, the predatory payday loans, and the other kinds of predatory finance that the commercial banking system has become in this country. So the problem isn't simply a debt write-down, it's to restructure the financial system to make it into a public utility instead of a private monopoly.
Oh, right. I totally endorse that. That sounds great. So I saw you wrote recently about the question was about whether it wouldn't be inflationary doing all these bailouts, and you said no, that we're actually in an era of deflation, and basically that the way the Fed has been doling out money to the financial sector actually makes it worse, the deflation issue worse. Can you explain that?
There are two kinds of prices in the economy. One are the prices for goods and services that people pay, the consumer price index for food, clothing, shelter, and the other is the price of assets. What we have is asset price inflation. In other words, the banks have been bailed out to lend more and more money against assets. In other words, the collateral that they lend against. So banks have created this huge rise in housing prices. The whole basis of middle class wealth has been created by banks increasing the price of real estate, the price of stocks and bonds, the price of assets. But by increasing the price of real estate, that means that in order to buy a home of your own or in order to rent a home, you have to pay more and more of your income to the financial sector, to the bank for the mortgage. Rent is for paying interest. Speculators and absentee owners and the real estate developers will borrow money from a bank in order to pay all of the rent, basically for interest, and what they're after is the capital gain, the price rise. But as the prices rise for real estate, stocks, and bonds, that means that the rest of the population has to pay more and more money, not only for housing, but for a retirement income, for monopoly goods and services, and we turn into a rentier economy. That is, more and more money is paid for economic rent, not for profits, not for wages, not for goods and services, but just for assets that are financed by bank credit. And this is where the financial sector has actually ended up undercutting the economy. And this is not capitalism in the sense that this is not industrial capitalism. It's not what people expected in the 19th century. Finance capitalism can be thought of as the failure of industrial capitalism to free economies from rent and interest and from the legacy of feudalism, and finance capitalism that we have is the road back to feudalism. It's neo-feudalism. It's neo-serfdom. It's turning the population into debt serfs, debt peons who have to pay all of the income that they have basically to the creditor and don't have enough money to buy the goods and services. So, of course, goods and service prices are actually falling because nobody has enough money to buy them. And that's because more and more of their money is paid for access to financialized housing, financialized public utilities, financialized monopolies.
That's my argument, too, that you could pour money into the real economy in the form of universal basic income or any other kind of helicopter money, you know, relieving student debts, et cetera. And because that economy is actually short of money, it would just fill that gap, the difference between debt and the money available to repay it. And the money that trickles up, that goes into the other, there are actually two economies, and the money that goes into the financialized economy, it never comes back. I mean, I'm not sure, I wish I could prove that, but it seems to me you can just see that that's true, that the rich don't, there's only so many shoes you can buy, and then all the rest of your big money goes to big things like bribing politicians or buying islands or yachts or something like that.
There's a simple explanation. The money doesn't go back to the real economy, to the production and consumption economy. The money does go into the financial economy, but it goes into bidding up the price of houses and stocks and bonds, and this price can go down, and it can disappear. It can be eradicated and always is in a financial collapse. So the question is, what is the economy? There are really two economies. There's the production and consumption economy of workers producing goods and services and then buying what they produce. And there's the financial economy. It's really more than a financial economy. It's the finance, insurance, and real estate sector, the FIRE sector. When the money goes out of the goods and service economy into the rent and interest economy, then it goes from the 99% into the hands of the 1%. So you can have the Main Street, the 95% or 99% of the population, and the financial economy that are becoming very much like the hereditary landlord class that ruled Europe from the Middle Ages until the 19th century, when industrial capitalism was supposed to free economies from this predatory class. And obviously, industrial capitalism seemed to be taking off until World War I, but then World War I changed everything, and since then you've had a degeneration of industrial capitalism into its antithesis, finance capitalism, which is really a fallback into neo-feudalism and neo-serfdom. Where will the Americans immigrate to when there are no jobs and they've lost their houses?
Yeah, they'll go to Mexico. I saw a joke about that, something about, are you coming in or going out?
Well, they'd better learn Spanish.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, so another joke, it was the Statue of Liberty said, another year like this and I'm going back to France.
Yep.
Well, it's been great talking to you.
By the way, the Statue of Liberty, the iconography of holding the torch, the iconography occurs very early in civilization's chart. When Hammurabi canceled the debts, he raised the sacred torch. And an announcement, the ruler has raised the sacred torch, was a symbol in Babylonia for proclaiming a debt cancellation.
Oh, cool. We have that right in New York Harbor.
Yes.
Okay, that's great. All right. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you, as always.
The same here. I hope we can get into more details next time.
We'll have more from this discussion with Michael Hudson and Ellen Brown on our next edition of It's Our Money. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.